Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Classic Replay. Justin here again to introduce this week's show from the archive. I really enjoyed hosting this one back in September 2010 when I was joined for the first time by famed physicist and now a Nobel Prize winner, Sir Roger Penrose. He was joined by scientist theologian Alistair McGrath to debate the recent book by Stephen Hawking that had been causing a stir at the time, The Grand Design, and what it had to say about God, the universe, and much more. So thanks for tuning in, and don't forget you can find many more shows from the Unbelievable archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Roger, tell us a little bit about your background, because I don't know that you particularly have any faith of any kind, but your passion has always been science. When did that begin?
Well, I had a father who was a scientist. He was a professor of human genetics at University College London, and it was more on the biological side. His family came from a completely non-scientific background. He was a Quaker. His family was Quaker. He was really more of an atheist, actually, but he was very much held to Quaker values and that sort of thing, and that was quite strong with him. I was brought up without any religious background, certainly scientific. Both my parents, my mother was medically trained, and she also was not religious, although I don't think her parents were, as far as I'm aware. Her mother was actually an anti-Semitic Jew,
right. Keeping an interesting
quiet.
Combination.
Yes, well, she must have had some row with her family or something, right. Like that. I'm not quite sure what it was, because she kept it completely secret.
Right,
it was quite remarkable. But her father's family, her father, I think, was not religious or not particularly religious, but his family were very much Christian, Church of England. So that gives you a sort of background there.
I mean, you are a member of the British Humanist Association, which suggests that, therefore, you have, as it were, taken a stance. You do not believe in God.
What I would say is I don't believe in any established religion. Of course, the word God can be interpreted in all sorts of different ways, and that depends on what interpretation you give, how I would relate to that. But I'm certainly not religious in the sense of following any religious doctrine.
And you've always found that scientific inquiry has given you more than enough, if you like, view on the world to not require anything more than that.
Yes, although, of course, there are questions. Some people would say there are questions beyond science. I would certainly say there are questions that are not addressed by present-day science. It might be that science will have to extend its scope so that it covers things that we don't think of as part of science now, such as moral values and things of that nature, which one takes not to be part of science. And I certainly agree they're not part of science as we understand that term now. But perhaps we will get a deeper understanding of the meaning of these things at some later.
Absolutely. And many people, in the wake of what Stephen Hawking have said, have been speculating about whether he had a change of mind in his own way.
Yes.
And obviously, in A Brief History of Time, he talks about the idea that it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, as it were, to
to be able to understand the theory of everything, and for then we should know the mind of God. Some people took that to be a suggestion that there is an ultimate divine source to this being able to understand. But
well, having known Stephen since a long time before he actually wrote that book, I would have said there is no change of mind involved in the book that he's just brought out with Mladenov, however you pronounce his name. He certainly states it more categorically, that the fact that he doesn't regard a creator to be needed in scientific view, which I think was always his position. I think I always took the comment in the Brief History of Time about knowing the mind of God as in a metaphorical sense, and I think that was how he meant it. Mm. And as far as I'm aware, that was not in the original thing he wrote, and then the publishers say, well, look, you've got to say something. Say your position is in relation to God, and so he put that in afterwards. But I think I take that as completely metaphorical and not his, that he's expressing any religious view there.
Well, we'll get into the discussion on whether it's valid for him to be, as it were, using a scientific theory to make a deduction as to whether God is a plausible entity or not, or whether he's a redundant entity in some sense. Our other guest today on the programme, of course, is Alistair McGrath, who's a Professor of Theology at King's College London. As I said, Alistair, you have a background in science, but you've never felt that the one in any way excludes the other. Indeed, it was the very process of becoming more aware of scientific principles that led you to a certain faith position.
Well, I think when I was much younger, when I was a teenager studying, you know, the hard sciences at high school, I did take the view that science kind of way eroded the conceptual space for God. Although I think that was simply because I was only 16 or 17 at the time and actually probably didn't understand the thing very well. But I was very dogmatic at that stage and was very, very clear that, you know, science disproved God, that sort of stuff. I think science really fascinated me. It still does. I mean, it's the most wonderful thing. I think Roger's articulated very well, you know, some of the reasons for that. And I went up to Oxford to study chemistry. In fact, Roger and I were at the same college, turns out. It's very nice. A good college, too. That was really very, very exciting. And while I was there, I really had to do some serious rethinking. I came to the conclusion, I hope rightly, that actually there wasn't really a tension between science and faith. Actually, the two could be read together in a very positive, complementary way. So I switched from being an atheist to being a Christian. And then I changed direction slightly. I went and did my doctoral research more in biological sciences and then switched to theology. But I still love sciences. And one day, maybe I'll build myself a little telescope and look at the Milky Way at night. But the problem is, in England, there's so much light pollution, you can't actually see it very well.
This is true. Let's just have a brief introduction to what M-theory is for those who aren't initiated. M-theory, Sir Stephen Hawking tells us, claims to come about as close as possible to get so far to a theory of everything, a unifying theory of the physical laws and the universe. Now, it has some interesting repercussions. It's based on the idea of string theory and that there are extra dimensions beyond the three or four dimensions we experience, and it posits the idea that there is a whole lot of other universes, a multiverse, if you like, and our fine-tuned universe, this universe which is so finely tuned in terms of the physical constants that existed at the point of the Big Bang to allow life, carbon-based life, to develop, that massive, massive, unlikely occurrence is rendered not so unlikely if there are something like 10 to the 500 other universes with all of their own different constants, and we happen to be the one in which life was able to be produced. So those are some of the consequences. In particular, he claims that at a quantum level, because of the law of gravity, the universe can and will create itself out of nothing. That seems to pose a number of problems philosophically. What are we actually talking about when it comes to the idea of nothingness? Well, we'll be looking at some of those questions with my guests on today's programme. So, Roger, we'll come to your own theory later in the programme, but what do you make of Stephen's M theory?
Well, of course, it's not his. I had to review this book, actually, for Financial Times, and I found that really rather difficult. Partly because a lot of it was very much things that he said and other people have said before, which weren't particularly new. There was something which did seem to be new to me, an expression of what his view is on reality. Now, I've always found this rather puzzling, and in my review I commented on a conversation that I had with Stephen Hawking many years ago, in the 70s sometime, when he was just exploring his ideas about black hole evaporation, the idea that black holes are not entirely black in the sense that they do emit radiation, although very, very little and very slowly. But if you would wait for long enough, and it would have to be for a large black hole, something like a Google years, that's 10 to the power 100 years. The black hole will finally disappear.
With a pop, as you say.
A pop, yes. Well, it's amazing, because you can have this black hole, which is about the mass of a small galaxy. And after a Google years, it will disappear with a rather disappointing little pop, you see. I say pop. It's actually about the power of an artillery shell.
Yes.
You see,
not that impressive in the big scheme of things.
So. Yes, exactly. And then his final comment was that black holes and white holes are the same thing. Now, a white hole is a black hole reversed in time, which starts with some sort of strange object that nothing can get into, and then finally it explodes into ordinary matter. You see, it's a time going the opposite direction. And if you have time reversibility, you should be able to have one or the other. The main problem with this, there are two problems. One is it violently disobeys the second law of thermodynamics, which no doubt we'll come to.
Yeah, and which really forms the key aspect of your own work.
Exactly.
In this area.
That's right. It is an absolutely key thing. But the other point, which is what really worried me more, was that the geometry, at least when you get up close to it in a certain sense, the geometry is not the same. It doesn't make any sense. And so his answer, basically, as it sort of emerged gradually, was that he regarded space-time as a subjective thing, that different observers would have a different perspective on what was space-time. Right. Now, this might be, when you get down to some quantum level, of course, that might be all right, and I wouldn't mind that. But this was for a huge thing, you know, a great enormous black hole, which could be millions of kilometers across. And this didn't make any sense to me. And so this was an argument that we've never resolved. But his way of saying this was that there was some kind of subjectivity about space-time.
A lot of people have concentrated on is some of the implications of the theory.
Quantum mechanics.
Yes. I mean, also this idea that it implies a multiverse. That there are some 10 to the 500 universes, because of its, you know, the idea of string theory and all that.
Well, there are different ideas which we have. The 10 to the 500 is specifically to do with the developments of string theory.
Absolutely. And I mean, Alistair, I mean, as an interested scientist on this, what do you make of this M theory that Hawking has, you know, that at least we've had the layman's view of in the articles that we've had? You may not have had time to read the book yet, but what do you make of it? Does it pose significant questions for you in the whole area of whether there is a God necessary for...
Well, I think there are two things to say here. One is that M theory is a theory, and it's a way of looking at things which is slightly tentative, you know, that this might be the best way of looking at things, but there are issues that need to be followed through. So the first thing I want to emphasize is, you know, we do have to be careful about the provisionality of this. I mean, in some of the debates, for example, about Hawking's book, you almost get the impression that some people, not Hawking himself, but some people are saying, well, of course, science now knows the answer to this question. It's called M theory. Actually, it's not really. It's just a staging post along the long road of science. We try to make sense of things. At the moment, this looks quite hopeful, but it's clear that further work needs to be done. And the question is, well, will that take some future? So,
Go ahead. Yes.
Yes.
I'm going to say I think it's actually stronger than that.
Okay.
That what is referred to as M theory isn't even a theory.
Yes.
It's a collection of ideas, hopes, aspirations.
Exactly. Mm.
It's not even a theory. And I think the book is a bit misleading in that respect. It gives you the impression that here is this new theory which is going to explain everything. It's nothing of the sort. It's not even a theory, and it certainly has no observational... Partly is this 10 to the 500 you refer to.
Exactly. I'll throw in a few questions here, because I did ask members of the online Unbelievable group at the Premier Community if they had any questions to ask during the course of our programme. I mean, David Wilson, for instance, asks, Stephen Hawking claims the following. M-theory is the only candidate for a complete theory to the universe. It is finite, and if it is finite, and this has yet to be proved, it will be a model of the universe that creates itself. I mean, this is one of the interesting aspects of what he appears to be saying, is that M-theory shows that the universe can create itself, so to speak, out of nothing. I mean, is that something which science can ever really tell us or be definitive? Take
a certainly not on? Doing it yet. I think the book suffers rather more strongly than many. I mean, it's not an uncommon thing in popular descriptions of science to latch on to some idea, particularly things to do with string theory, which have absolutely no support from observation. They're just nice ideas that people have tried to explore.
But they will always remain theoretical. I mean,
always is too strong. It may well be they just be refuted, but even that is something which is... They're very far from any kind of observational
or testability.
Test, yes. They're hardly science.
What do you make?
Well, I think that's right, and that's my concern about this. I think there is a certain sense in which, when you popularize science, there is always a degree of simplification involved. And unfortunately, simplification very often leads to overstatement, to make points. And I must admit, I did find myself alarmed at points in that book, because I just felt this is actually really rather speculative, being stated as if it is kind of way, you know, what everyone thinks. And a part of me wondered, well, look, this is not just Stephen Hawking and another person, you know, who actually wrote these sentences, you know, because it did strike me as just going beyond them. And the other point, of course, is just, you know, there is then the very big issue of the interpretation of this. If this is right, what are its broader, what you might call metaphysical implications? And again, this is sort of, you know, very speculative stuff, and it's great fun, and I love doing it myself. In fact, I'm very bad at doing it, I have to admit. But, you know, we need to be aware that sometimes in popular presentations, it's almost as if there is this absolutely secure theory, and it follows logically and necessarily from that this is true. Whereas, in fact, it's much more tentative and explorative than that. It's a great discussion, but it is really more tenuous.
Well, absolutely, and perhaps, you know, I don't know whether it is, in that case, far too strong a thing, as it seems to be what he's written, or with the help of this co-author, that something like, because there is a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing, why the universe exists, why we exist. Now, there may be a line of thinking behind that, which kind of buttresses that statement. But for most people, there was, you know, the obvious philosophical objection to that is, you know, how can something come to exist without having a cause? Does simply the philosophy refute the science, or is
that... Well, we need to be careful here, I think, because as someone who enjoys science and knows something about history, I'm aware that very often philosophy has overreached itself in critiquing science and actually been shown to be really rather wrong. You know, people will often say, well, you can't believe this because it's logically inconsistent, but actually, you know, the evidence does seem to demand that. So we have to be very careful about this. But my concern would more be that there's almost this arbitrary termination, you know, that yes, we can trace back a line of causality, but actually at this point we've got a something that creates itself, and that seemed to me to be awfully close to an assertion. And I was puzzled by it. I was also puzzled by, at least as I've read, I mean, it may be there's a much more sophisticated thought process lying behind it, which isn't adequately expressed in the book, but it almost seemed to be saying, well, we've got these laws of nature, so that kind of way, you know, gets rid of the idea of God. I mean, if I could just say to listeners, I'm taking Roger Penrose's excellent book, I'm now going to drop it on the table. I mean, you know, one could describe mathematically the fall of that book. And you might say, well, you know, so, you know, that's the end of God. You know, we can describe these things mathematically. But actually, it's not really. It's much more, if you're a Christian, you'll say, well, God's made an ordered universe with certain things embedded in the structure of things. And this actually illustrates that orderedness. So I think, you know, I'm not saying this is right. I'm just saying there's a much bigger discussion to be had here.
Roger, do you feel that science can, in any sense, have things to say about the metaphysical side of things, whether there is a transcendent cause to the universe, or is it always bounded by what is actually testable?
I think I'd probably take the view that science it, in principle, can extend into areas that one tends to think of it not being part. It's dangerous because, you know, people tend to do this certainly prematurely, and often, you know, one needs to impose other things which are taken as being outside science, such as moral values and so on. But certainly science can have a big thing to say about a lot of these issues.
What about the multiverse hypothesis, which again is in a sense completely untestable? Yeah. We could never, you know, have any contact with a multiverse in that sense.
I think I wouldn't be quite as pessimistic in saying untestable. I just think it's wrong. That's my, you see, of course I'm expressing an opinion when I say things like that. It's just that it doesn't help. I mean, there are many things which are promoted these days as scientific, which are pretty marginal science. Now, one of these things is, I mean, also the word multiverse means different things. There is this 10 to the 500 different M theories or whatever it is, and these are different schemes in which you might have constants of nature being different, and not just that, but all sorts of things are different. And the argument is that of all these different possibilities, we live in one where life is possible. Most of them, life is not possible. Now, that's one type of scheme. They all kind of coexist, but we find ourselves
in the one that is habitable for human life.
Mm. That's right. And that's what's called the anthropic argument, which has some justification. It's overused, I think. And this is a place where it's overused. It's an excuse for not having a good theory. You say you've got...
I mean, I sometimes hear some people suggest that it's partly been developed as a reaction to the possible Christian or God implications of the Big Bang and its fine-tuned aspects, and that, if you like, it's an anything-but-God approach to science where, well, let's hypothesize a multiverse because the other alternative of a creator God is simply we can't go down that route.
I think you're right. There is a question. I mean, I'm not even convinced about the question, but let's come to that.
Yeah.
Whether I mean, it's just the fine-tuning thing, because there are many examples of constants of nature which, had they been something else, life as we know it couldn't have existed, and is the case. Now, the question is, could these constants have been anything other than the values we see for say, mathematical reasons? Mm. Is that possible? We don't know enough about the physics. Is it possible that if they had some different value, some life, not as we know it, but something entirely different of which we have no conception could exist? So I think it's an argument that we can't take very far, certainly not at the moment.
Mm. You do speak yourself about the fine-tuning argument. Obviously, you wrote a book called A Fine-Tuned Universe, Alistair. Do you see the multiverse as a form of let's find a different explanation because God is one that we don't want to?
Well, I think it is used for that reason by some people, though that by no means invalidates it. I think it's always helpful here just to remember that if we'd been having this conversation 100 years ago, I mean, the prevailing consensus would have been, well, you know, it's always been here, that's the way it is. And actually the realization that actually the universe seems to have come into existence like this, which Roger describes very well in his book, you know, is actually quite recent. I mean, really it caught on, 50 years ago? And actually it has changed the debate very, very significantly. But I would want to say that for me, fine-tuning is actually something that's observable. You can see these constants or work out what they are, and you can speculate what would happen if they were tweaked, and you begin to realize that actually there's a very narrow window of possibilities. And you can also extend this from physics to chemistry or biochemistry. For example, if you look at the properties of transition metals like copper or zinc or vanadium, all of which play a major role in biological systems, you begin to realize that things that are essential for life might not happen if the quantum mechanical properties of these metals were slightly different. So again, there's a picture there. The big debate is, what does this mean? And for me, I would not base a case for God upon this at all. I would just say it chimes in or resonates with the way in which a Christian thinks, which is very nice. But it's not hard objective proof.
Is there an inference we can draw? I mean, we might not say it's absolute proof.
Well, inferences are always tentative. I want to make that point. I'm not talking about proof here. Indeed, the fact that, you know, there's a very interesting debate between those who take the position of a universe and multiverse, for which I have great respect on each side, though I have to admit I prefer the universe for scientific reasons, indicates actually that this simple model of science proving things really does need a bit of restatement, because you can hold quite different positions for very good reasons. But certainly for me, there is something very odd going on here. And I think that's the instinct of an awful lot of scientists. You know, I'm not quite sure what this means, but there's something odd, something strange about this.
We're going to come in the next portion of the programme to looking at the conformal cyclic cosmology model, yes. I think, is one way of putting it.
Well, see, I like having all the C's, then you can.
Well, it's good. It's alliterative, yes, absolutely. But we'll come to that. I mean, but as we, as it were, conclude our little discussion here on Hawking's view, you do believe Hawking's has got it wrong, and you believe that. Do you believe that this then is a dangerous thing to be doing, to asserting that God is not the cause, because it's based on such flimsy scientific.
I mean, it's certainly flimsy in the sense that the science, certainly M theory, doesn't even exist as a theory, so that it's you can't base it on that. Wouldn't say that necessarily the underlying idea has to be wrong. I mean, there might be a sort of conjuring itself into existence aspect to it. I mean, mathematics in a certain sense does that, conjures itself into existence. Of course, that's different from physics. To what extent, it relates to this question about how do mathematics and physics interrelate with each other, which is a very interesting but somewhat separate question. But if mathematics can somehow conjure itself into existence, you might say, well, does the physical question have a similar type of answer? There's no way in which we can deduce that on the basis of what we know now. And I certainly would disagree if Stephen is trying to say that our present knowledge of physics is telling us that the universe conjures itself into existence. I wouldn't accept that.
We're going to continue debating and discussing God, the universe, fine-tuning, and the way now that Sir Roger Penrose, who is one of our guests on the programme today, views the universe, and you'll find out his fascinating view of the universe, the so-called eons of time that exist, and how the universe in some sense is reborn again and again, if his view holds correctly, and we'll be looking at that in more detail in just a moment's time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, this Saturday afternoon. Don't forget we're online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. We're going to be continuing to address this question of Stephen Hawking, God and the universe. My special guests today are Roger Penrose, who worked alongside Hawking in developing some of those theories of gravitational singularities, etc. His new book, Cycles of Time, is an alternative theory on the nature of the universe and the Big Bang. And with Alistair McGrath today, we're looking at the question of whether Hawking's so-called M theory actually does make God a redundant entity. We've already heard that Roger is not a theist by any means. He doesn't believe in God, but whether M theory is, if you like, a way of shoving God out of the picture in terms of the Big Bang cosmology that it represents is a question we've been looking at today. We're going to continue in the show, and don't forget we'll be looking at some of your feedback as well towards the end of today's programme. Well, I read the book, Roger, Cycles of Time. I have to confess, as I said earlier, a lot of the maths is far beyond me, but I could get the general sense of what you're talking about. And would you like to explain now, just in a few minutes, what the essence of this theory is and how it differs from current theories that are out there of Big Bang cosmology?
Yes, well, the position I'm taking is that there was an initial state of the universe, well, it used to be called the universe, I'm calling it our present eon, and I'll explain that in a minute. There was a Big Bang, but this Big Bang, something went on before that. And one of the main reasons for arguing this is the second law of thermodynamics. And the book is in three parts. The first part is a detailed discussion of this second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics, roughly speaking, tells us that things get more and more random as time goes on, which in a certain sense is sort of obvious. You see, things just sort of disintegrate. But what's not obvious is if you run the clock backwards, that means that prior to this and prior to that and prior to that, there must have been more and more organization. And there's almost a paradox in present-day cosmology, which is if you look at the main evidence for the Big Bang, the view that this was the origin of the universe, this comes from this thing called the cosmic microwave background. Now, the cosmic microwave background is radiation coming from all directions. It's at a very low temperature, as observed, about 3 degrees above absolute zero. So practically absolute zero. Very uniformly over the whole sky. And this is argued to be what's sometimes referred to as the flash of the Big Bang, but cooled down to this very low temperature because of the expansion of the universe.
And indeed, it was this discovery of the CMB
that
caused particularly some of your mentors at university to change their view of the so-called steady state theory of the universe.
Indeed, and even mine in a sense, because yeah. I was quite taken by the steady state model.
And it was a massive change in that sense to change from believing in essentially an eternal universe to a universe that had a beginning time and space.
That's right. I mean, I had a sort of conflict because Einstein's general theory of relativity more or less tells you that there's got to be a Big Bang. And if it was between Einstein's general relativity and the steady state model, I would go for Einstein's general relativity because it's a very beautiful and theory which is very self-consistent and so on and so forth. And so I struggled for a long time with trying to make these two things consistent with each other, and I realized this couldn't be done. Not without having negative energies and bad things like that. But then the observations of this microwave background came along, and everybody, not completely everybody, but almost all cosmologists came round to the view, including Dennis Sharma, who I learnt all my cosmology from pretty well when I was a graduate student. And they came round and said, no, there really was a Big Bang, steady state is wrong. Now, I'm still saying steady state as understood is wrong. There was a Big Bang. But there was also, in my view, something before the Big Bang. Now, there are other models than mine which suggest that there was something before. But these models involve the universe collapsing again. You see, what we have is a universe which is not only expanding, but where this expansion is now seen to be accelerating. And this is something which was took people rather by surprise in 1998, these observations of two groups on distant supernova exploding stars came to the conclusion that the universe was accelerating in its expansion. Now, this actually is not inconsistent with Einstein's theory. In fact, it's consistent with the modification of his initial theory that Einstein himself put forward in 1917 for basically the wrong reason. He wanted this because he wanted a universe which was basically unchanging, static universe. And this wouldn't work for his initial equations, so he introduced this term, which is referred to as the cosmological constant, in order to make the static universe. Shortly after that, observations that the universe was actually expanding showed that this was wrong, and Einstein then took the view that this was his greatest mistake. Now, he was such a great scientist that even his greatest mistake turned out to be true. So it appears that the universe really is expanding in the way that it would do in accordance with most of the solutions of his equation.
Now, the way that I understand it from my understanding of your theory of the universe is that this expansion will continue, and many people would say, well, that just carries on indefinitely, eventually we find the heat death of the universe. Everything runs down eventually, according to the second law of thermodynamics, such that everything loses its energy ultimately, and we kind of finish in a sterile universe, which really there's nothing exists there apart from the radiation that's left over. Yeah. But you actually have this interesting theory that actually that's where things get interesting.
Yes. Well, you see, that was my view. So it was about 5 years ago, a little over 5 years ago, when I was starting to worry about this extremely boring universe. You see, here we have this universe with this expansion getting more and more boring, as it seems like that. The most exciting thing that would be going on in this universe is the final disappearance of black holes through the Hawking evaporation process, and they go off with a pop. You see. Now, it seemed to me that this is about the most boring thing you can imagine, sitting around for a googol years waiting for this blasted thing to go off pop, you see. And it's a pretty much of an anticlimax when it does it. And this is a highly emotional argument, I may say.
Yes.
But it did seem to me that, you know, for this wonderful universe which we're living in, and surely is this, there must be something more to it than this rather dreadful, dreary end that we seem to be coming to. And then I began to think, But who's going to be around? Not us, you see. But some, what's going to be around will be nothing like, only things like, basically things like photons, you see. Now, the main constituents of the universe, the particles that will be around at that time will be mainly photons, almost entirely photons. Now, these photons have no mass. And things which have no mass, according to Einstein's relativity, don't experience the passage of time. So eternity, you can put it like this, eternity is no big deal if you're a photon, you see. So that photons, I mean, I'm not saying that photons have experiences, but it's the idea that whatever was around there, eternity is as nothing.
Mm.
And it's related to work that I had done previously in looking at discussions of... It was purely a mathematical trick, you see. How do you treat infinity in general relativity? Okay, there's a neat way of doing it. You squash infinity down until it becomes a finite boundary to your space. Now, this squashing process is one which things without mass don't even notice. If you have mass, you can build clocks, you can make rulers, and you can measure how big things are. If you don't have mass, you
there's
can't
no meaningful sense in which time or space
that's
exists.
Right. There is a lot of the structure still there. In fact, most of the structure is still there, but the only thing which is not still there is the scale. So big and small become equivalent.
Indistinguishable. And this that's is the right. point at which, as it were, the next eon begins in the form of another Big Bang.
Yes, that's right.
Because you get a singularity, if you like, of wideness and of smallness is kind of yes, the way my mind understands
yes,
it.
Yes, that's right. But you see, you have to be massless for this to be true. That's the point. At both ends, in the remote future, the idea is that the massive things disappear. There's only...
And so we have this situation then where, if your theory is correct, we live in a universe that is itself the product of a previous eon of a universe.
That's
and
right.
will itself produce another universe to come.
That's right.
And is this, in the sense then, essentially an endless thing? Does it require an explanation of, well, when did the first Big Bang come from?
Of course, you're asking the next question.
Yeah.
And I'm not addressing that question. But I'm... Okay. It's a nice thing to think about. And there are various issues in which relate to the earlier discussion about constants of nature. For example, you see, it might be the case, and I'm not taking a position on this, it might be the case that in one eon the constants of nature differ from the constants of nature in the next eon. So you could imagine that most of these eons are not inhabitable by
but
life.
We happen to live in the fine-tuned eon.
That's it, yes.
So it is, again, the anthropic principle,
yes.
Not so much of a multiverse, but a continuation of
that's right.
universes.
They don't coexist.
They don't coexist at the same time.
But they're sequential. One after the other. Now, I'm not saying this happens. And I'm not, in some respects, I don't like it very much. See, I'm ambivalent. I don't have a position on this. It would be nice for your
Let's hear then, Alistair. What's your reaction to the CCC model?
Well, I think my reaction is great interest. And that might be good if I just laid out on the table some questions for discussion. I think, as I read the book, and indeed as you've just been talking, I think one of the things that occurred to me is that the model of the eons, the eon before where we are now. I mean, are we going back to, in effect, the recycling of eons? In other words, at what point do we stop? Or do you feel at some point that there is a definite initiation, which we can call a beginning? Or is it this constant process almost of reformation or renewal or morphing of eons? So, in effect, it's a continuous eternal process.
Yes. I don't know. Mm. I mean, it's a short answer. And you could contemplate either possibility. It could be that they continually go on indefinitely and there is no beginning, as with the steady state model.
Yes.
Or it could be that there is some kind of progression in which, say, the constants of nature progress and there was an initial situation which
that makes sense. And the second thing that occurred to me is... I mean, it's the sort of question Karl Popper would ask. How would you go about checking this out? Because clearly what you were doing is saying, look, there are these things, and particularly these fairly recent observations which can be interpreted in this way. Therefore, you know, in effect, there is a sort of degree of increasing distance from the observations in terms of the theory you're developing. I mean, what would need to be observed for you to say, actually, I was wrong, or even better from your point of view, I was right.
There is a clear test.
Mm, yes.
In fact, there's probably several.
Mm-hmm.
But the one which I've been concentrating on, and it is mentioned in the book, right at the very end, is that you could actually see into the previous eon in a certain sense. Now, it's not quite seeing, it's that the major events in the previous eon which would be observable to us would be encounters between enormous black holes in galactic centers. Now, we know that perhaps all galaxies have large black holes in their centers. Our own has a black hole which is about 4 million times the mass of our sun. So it's pretty big by ordinary astrophysical standards. It's pretty small by comparison with certain other black holes which are known to exist, such as some which are about the have about the mass of a small galaxy. Now, since these things exist in the centers of galaxies, and galaxies exist in clusters, they run round each other and every now and again run into each other. Now, this is observed. We've seen galaxies observing, hitting each other, running through each other, in fact. Now and again, when these encounters happen, their black holes will encounter each other. And when this happens, they could capture each other and finally swallow each other up. And in the process, this is absolutely standard physics as we understand it. In the process of doing this, just at the last moments of this encounter, they emit absolutely huge amounts of energy in the form of gravitational radiation. So a substantial fraction of the entire mass of these black holes will be emitted in these things called gravitational waves. That's the gravitational analog of light. It's ripples in space-time. And these things carry energy. Now, this goes out in the ordinary picture of things. I mean, it's happening in our eon, you see, that black holes do this. And when they encounter each other, these gravitational waves will escape outwards, and you say, to infinity. Well, infinity, as I say, is no big deal in this scheme. And it matches on to the Big Bang of the next eon. And so will cause slight disturbances in the cosmic microwave background. And these disturbances are in principle observable to us. Now, about 2 years ago, I was in Princeton, and I talked to David Spergel, who is one of the real experts in analyzing the cosmic microwave background. And I said, has anybody ever seen evidence of these ripples? It's like a pond, you see, and each time a raindrop hits the pond, the ripple comes out. And so what you're seeing is something like that ripple. But after a while, you see all the ripples merge, and it looks like a great mess. And so you have to do a statistical analysis to see whether there really are these individual events which cause the ripples. Now, so I asked David Spergel, has anybody ever seen this? And his response was, no, nobody's ever seen this, but then nobody's ever looked. So, and then he said, well, you know, give me a few weeks and I'll see if I can find out. Well, to cut a long story short, it was not so easy as that. He gave it to a graduate student who was working with him, and they did a lot of complicated analysis. And the final upshot of all this, it was a little bit tantalizing, or I should say fundamentally tantalizing to me, because it looks as though there may be a signal of this kind, but it's slightly distorted through, it would have to be that it is slightly distorted through irregularities in the matter distribution in our eon, which we know are there. There are large voids, for instance, which contain much less matter than there are in other regions. The question is, do these voids and the actual distribution of them throughout the universe, or throughout our present eon, do they cause the distortion which seems to be needed in order for these signals to be there in my picture?
It is a fascinating area. I don't know, Alistair, whether for you, in a sense, this in any way has anything to say to the concept of whether we need an originator, though, for this whole thing.
Well, I was going to come to that. I mean, I have two questions for Roger, and then a reflection, so to speak.
Go ahead.
And the reflection is that clearly one of the issues that arises from what Roger has written, from what others have written, is can one in any way map a scientific story and a religious story onto each other? They're fundamentally different. So you can't just say, oh, look, you know, we can kind of say this is equivalent to the Christian story. I mean, it's not that simple. But because we're inquisitive creatures, we always want to do this kind of thing. And certainly for me, it's a very interesting thing to do. And for me, the Christian narrative is one of beginnings and endings. You know, things begin and they are going to end. And it's a very dramatic picture. And what I'd want to say, I think, is just that while all these questions are open, it's still clear that the narrative that Roginal is proposing can be at least brought into contact with this. Back in 1948, you may remember, there was a very famous debate between Bertrand Russell and Frederick Copleston, and it was all about, you know, is there a God and so on. And Russell was quite well scientifically informed. And it was absolutely clear that one of the cornerstones of his approach was, well, of course, the universe has always been here, so, you know, we don't need a creator. So, end of discussion. And actually, you know, I'm not saying the discussion has necessarily gone in a radically different direction, but certainly there is a new energy in it now as a result of these kind of considerations. I don't think we've seen the end of these discussions or debates, but I think they're certainly moving things in a very interesting direction. And for me, it's a good time to be a Christian person reflecting on these things, because there are lots of interesting things out there.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
If I can throw in another question that someone posted, this person, a skeptic as far as Christianity is concerned, he says, why is the positing of a supernatural transcendent creator who can also listen and respond to the prayers of human beings a simpler explanation than positing an infinite number of universes with different settings, or we might say an infinitely sequential number of universes in the eons frame? But in a sense, he's suggesting, you know, theologians seem to be suggesting, no, God started it. God lit the blue touch paper. Shouldn't we be looking for scientific explanations here? Isn't that a kind of dead end, really, in some way? Is what a lot of people seem to be suggesting.
Can I raise a question here that I'm not quite sure? I mean, there's the question of God starting it, you see. Now, starting seems to have a temporal significance. You say that there was it was related to Alistair's question earlier about whether the eons could go on indefinitely, or was there a sort of an initiation of these eons in some temporal sense? Or would you be happy with like in the old steady state model, that somehow you could imagine a creator which is atemporal, that somehow the entire thing outside time was the creation?
Well, I think that certainly you can. I mean, Augustine, who was a Christian theologian writing in the 4th century, kind of way mapped out the possibilities here, and he argued God created the world with time, but not in time, which he meant, in effect, that there's an atemporal dimension to this whole thing.
So it is saying that.
Yeah, he is.
Yes.
And that seems to me to make perfect sense, both in terms of how he got there, but also it makes perfect sense in more general terms as well. So going back to your question, I mean, I think one of the issues that may be behind this very interesting question is, if you have a universe and no God and a universe with a God, well, you're proposing one more entity, and it's simpler to believe in a universe with one fewer entity. And I suppose that my response would boil down to, what happens if the extra proposed entity has explanatory power? In other words, that you therefore can reduce the number of explanations you need elsewhere because of that. So, I mean, that needs a huge answer to it. And I've got a horrible feeling the way you're looking at we're running out of time. But good question.
I mean, another interesting question, and this, again, is very much philosophical in nature, but I think does relate to it, is that if you do talk of a God in any way being a cause for the universe, does that make sense? So Norman Hansen, who's another atheist, wanted to ask, given that God is supposed to exist outside of time and space, and so this relates to what we were just talking about, how does he manage to be a person at all, given that being a person involves a mind that contains and processes thoughts? So, you know, that's the way we understood personhood. Does it even make sense to talk of a God if we're saying that this God exists outside the boundaries of time and space?
Well, I think I'll give my quick answer, then I'm sure Roger wants to summon as well. I mean, I think the answer is, at one level, it makes no sense at all. But from a Christian way of looking at things, we are talking about a God who enters into the world in the form of human being. And so that actually gives a substance, a particularity to God, which otherwise would be absent. And so therefore, you know, I mean, the characteristic Christian insight is that we see God as he is in Christ. And therefore, that gives us a kind of anchor or a kind of traction, if you like, on God, which otherwise we wouldn't have. Which is why this idea of incarnation is of such importance to Christians. It's about God, if you like, who made things, entering into things. So that line of thought takes us off in, I think, some very good directions. Otherwise, that question is actually very difficult to answer.
Mm. Do these questions concern you at all, Roger?
Well, the thing is, I suppose I like to separate. I mean, you're using the word Christian quite often, and to me, the word Christian carries with it a lot of dogma and stories which I don't necessarily believe in. I mean, okay, I believe there was probably somebody, Jesus Christ existed as a person, but I can't believe that he was immaculately
divine
conceived or whatever
God.
It was, or that he rose from the dead. I mean, these things don't make sense to me. But is that part of a necessary part of being a Christian? Or do you take the term in a somewhat broader sense?
Well, I think what you could say is that there's a sort of spectrum of possibilities. Mm-hmm. And what I've described to you is where I stand on that spectrum, which is kind of way towards the, you described as dogmatic end. But it's more in terms of just a belief system. But you might be further down. And I mean, if I go back to something you mentioned before the break, I mean, you start to talk about this remarkable question about the relationship between mathematics and physics.
Yes.
Why is there this conformity between mathematics and the way things are? And you've written about this very elegantly, you know, almost in a Platonic way, about the real world, the ideal world, and the mathematical representations. I mean, a very good question for me is, why is that there?
Absolutely.
Because, a theistic or even a deistic interpretation actually is minimalist, but actually it is very interesting, I think.
No, I agree with that, certainly. I think these are profound questions, and they are questions that we need to think about. Whether we're in a position to answer any of them at the moment is another matter. But it's also related to the issue of consciousness, which I regard as crucial here. And I've often talked in terms of I call them three worlds, but I don't think of them as really separate in a real sense. But one of them being the world of Platonic world of mathematics, which I accept as having some kind of existence, not in a ordinary sense we think of as material objects existing. And then there's the material world, and then there is the world of consciousness. And these are initially seem like three quite separate things, but there are these very profound connections between each one and the next. The laws of physics, the physical world seems to act with such extraordinary precision according to mathematical laws, and not just any old mathematical laws. They're mathematical laws of deep sophistication
and elegance,
issues of that nature. And then there is consciousness, which seems to come about through the right kind of materials.
Are you always searching, though, for, in a sense, a materialistic explanation for these phenomena?
I don't like the word materialistic, I think, because it suggests that we know what matter is. And matter itself, you know, if you know about physics, then matter already becomes something very strange and
mysterious.
And it's not as though this is eliminating a problem to say, okay, we're just made of matter.
Mm.
To a physicist, that's hardly any kind of a solution. Because matter has become, the more we know about matter, the more obscure and dependent on mathematics it becomes. So it's as though we are part of mathematics. Then you say, well, what's the there's the sort of circularity to this, because in order to have access to mathematics at all, we need to use our conscious understanding. And so there is this circular aspect of the whole thing.
Of how we can depend on that very sort of consciousness, I suppose, and the rationality that we believe we are imbued with.
That's right.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll have our final thoughts coming up in just a moment. Time has flown by, of course, as it always does when we've got two fascinating guests in the studio. So we'll be concluding this discussion on God, the universe, and fine-tuning, and indeed the conformal cyclic cosmological model that we've been hearing about from Sir Roger Penrose during today. And our Christian guest Alistair McGrath has been interacting on the show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, we began, gentlemen, by looking at Stephen Hawking and what he stated, and I think you've both agreed that, to some extent, the book is too dogmatic in the way it seems to assert things as fact that are, in fact, very tentative and will remain tentative for a long time. It's the question that someone asked when I asked for comments and questions for this programme was why a physicist thinks he can make metaphysical claims as if they're authoritative. And that's sort of what we've been exploring today, where the boundary lies between the metaphysical world and the world we can actually inhabit and explore and ask scientific questions of. Do you feel like we will ultimately, Roger, reach this theory of everything, this elusive theory of everything? Is what you've suggested in some sense a theory of everything?
Certainly, I've not suggested anything which could be, I would call anything like a theory of everything. But I mean, whether there ever will be such a thing, I'd like to think there will be. But I don't see anything in existing science that could conceivably qualify as a theory of everything, no matter how what people talk about.
And even if it could, even if it did, would it actually, in a sense, and I use this metaphor, be a theory of everything as far as excluding or including God as?
Well, I think if we step back a bit and not even talk about God, but talk about consciousness, our theories are very far from really having any idea what's going on there. I mean, I've had my own suggestions there, but they certainly are not telling us what it is, even if right.
What do you make of the fact then that Hawking has essentially stated that God is not a factor? I mean, for you, must we remain simply agnostic as to God, or can we categorically say, yes, he is involved, or no, he is definitely not involved?
I tend to call myself an atheist rather than agnostic, but that doesn't mean I have doubts. You see, the doubts, it's a little I think the words don't quite convey appropriately the differences. I mean, an agnostic tends to be somebody who doesn't know and might take the view that some religions could be right, you see. Now, I don't take the view, I mean, I certainly would think it's highly unlikely that any existing religion in the sense of the stories that go along with it, you see, in particular with Christian religion being the Christ having a particular role in this. Whereas it doesn't mean that God, in a more metaphorical sense, couldn't exist. I mean, I don't like to use the term, and I tend to avoid using the word God anyway, because I think it carries too much baggage with it. And one has all sorts of ideas. Maybe you could pray to this entity and things like this, which don't seem to me to be necessarily.
But in a sense, the, let's say, deistic God, if you like, wouldn't necessarily be ruled out by any scientific theory. I'm just wondering whether science has ultimately the capacity to make those kinds of statements, which is essentially what Manway Sulima, who sent me this question, is asking. Can science be authoritative on metaphysical
claims? I think the trouble is the word ultimately here. You see, science has changed an awful lot already, and starts to address questions that it never could, you might have thought, were totally unaddressable. And also, you might say, how could we know where our universe came from, you see? And I'm trying to say, well, it depends on what you mean by the universe. You see, again, the meaning of the word may shift. And if you mean that thing which started with the Big Bang and went on to this indefinite expansion, I'm saying that thing which used to be recalled the universe, and I'm calling our present eon, could have an explanation, and that it had something which created it. But it wasn't, in this picture, a god. It was something which had a similar nature to itself. But then you can say, where did all that come
from?
Well,
that's
exactly.
Sort of goes back,
and then you could say, well, perhaps there's some self-consistency. You see, I think this is more or less what Stephen Hawking's trying to say, that there, although it's not as simple as he's saying it, there could be some deeper self-consistency or something which required this one thing to have a kind of manifestation which we would call existence. And I can conceive of something vaguely of that kind which could come out of developing scientific theories.
I mean, that's probably as far as most physicists on the scientific front will allow any talk of God into science, Alistair. I mean, but you are a Christian. You believe in the Trinitarian God of Christianity. What relevance at all, I suppose, I'm wondering, does that have to this whole debate we're having here? at the best, can we just get sort of a concept of a possibly deistic God? Why would we leap to the God of the Bible, ultimately?
Well, I think if there are Christians who are scientists who are listening to this programme, I mean, they'll be very, very interested by our discussion. They would probably make the point in response, though, that in their professional discourse and writing and research, they didn't talk about God at all. It's just not done thing. But it nevertheless gives them a framework for making sense of things. I think what I would say is that one of the great things of Christianity for me is that it gives a deeper background to the whole scientific enterprise. It gives you a framework within which you can make sense of science as well as make sense of its successes. So actually, for me, although I can no longer afford to do science, I'm afraid, one of the things I always enjoyed about science was the sense that, A, this is immensely pleasurable and worthwhile, but also the very religious thought that in studying nature, one is kind of way thinking God's thoughts after him. And so there was a very strong religious motivation for doing science. But your question is really asking whether science is going to, in effect, end up asking those and answering those metaphysical questions. And I have two problems with it. I don't think it is. Problem number one, as a historian, I notice how scientific mindsets change over time. And so you can freeze it at any moment in time, and there may be a consensus, but when you look 50 years down the line, it's changed. And so you have to be very careful about this, because there may be a consensus today which gives way to something quite different tomorrow. So we have to be aware of the provisionality of things. But secondly, one of my scientific heroes is Peter Medawar, who I read as a young man, and really he was inspiration. He's a biologist. He's already talked about young scientists, what they ought to be like and what they do. And his last book was called The Limits of Science. And just in a very cautious way, he was saying, look, there are going to be questions that lie beyond our scope, which are actually good questions. And he gives Karl Popper's examples, you know, why are we here? What's the point of life? And I think those are real questions which matter to all of us. If science can't answer them, well, you know, it doesn't bother me hugely, but they're still there on the table. And that's why I really want to say we need to keep asking these questions and reflecting on them. If science can't answer them, it's no criticism of science at all. I think one of the reasons why science is so successful is that it limits itself to what it knows it can answer. It can say something without having to say everything. I think the problem is with scientists who think you can say everything, and that's Roger is not in that category. I want to make that clear. But there are some who will pontificate a bit. And I think that's just bad for science, frankly.
I quite agree with what you're saying.
In that sense, Hawking, however much it may be down to the co-author as well, has overreached himself in some sense with his own sort of...
He's
what appeared to be more dogmatic
not the only
assertion.
One. I think a lot of people... I mean, there is a great confusion, I think, in a lot of popularizing science, to confuse a lot of things which are extraordinarily well established in science and which we have a huge amount of evidence which is continually supporting these ideas, many of them very ancient, like Newtonian mechanics and so on. And somehow these new wild ideas, now you might say I'm producing a wild idea, but these new wild ideas are put on the same level. And you know, but there's very little evidence for a lot of these things. Some of them, none whatsoever. And I would point a finger at string theory in particular.
We are going to have to draw it to a close there. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with me on the programme. It's been a really interesting discussion. This is the programme that gets you thinking. I hope you've had your thinking cap well and truly on your head this afternoon as you've listened. Thank you for joining us on the programme. My guests were Sir Roger Penrose, a famed mathematician, physicist, and also Alistair McGrath, Professor of Theology at King's College London. Well, thanks for listening to this week's Classic Replay. Hope you enjoyed it. And you can actually find a more recent show between Sir Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig back in autumn 2019 as part of Season 2 of The Big Conversation. And as always, you can find links to our newsletter, YouTube channel, Ways to Give, and the archive of past shows at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.